Happy Sabbath. I brought my own glass today. It's just water, trust me. I started feeling a little under the weather and was losing my voice last weekend down in Houston. And so this week, I've had a hard time speaking, and I wasn't feeling all that well, but I'm on the other side of it. My voice is still recovering, so I brought some warm water in case I need a little refreshment, a little help, a little assistance during the message. Happy to see those of you who are here. I hope all those who are out and enjoying the women's retreat, the women's weekend, are having as good a time as we are here as well. Last time I was here with you, we looked at the first two verses of 1 Timothy, because there are some who argue that Paul could not possibly have written the book of 1 Timothy. And we went through the reasons why they thought so, and we found that rather than finding reasons for doubt that Paul wrote 1 Timothy, we found many reasons for confidence and many reasons to be reassured that we know that it was Paul who wrote that book. And so with that understanding, with that guarantee that it was Paul who wrote the book to Timothy, we can now have more confidence in those words as Paul, an apostle, was writing to a member of the church to give him instructions. So let's now look at some of those instructions. Perhaps you remember when you were young playing the game telephone. Ever played the game telephone? The game is played by having everyone sit in a line or a circle or, you know, one next to the other, and the first person comes up with some sort of a phrase or a word or something and whispers it to the person next to him. And when you whisper, sometimes it's difficult to hear. And then that person would repeat the message down the line all the way to the end. And when we get to the end, we do a comparison with the first person and see what came out the other end, see if it's anything close to what the person had said. And of course, the game is not just for kids. There's a website called icebreakerideas.com, and one of their ideas was an icebreaker for a group, a team, for example, is to play this game of telephone. Some of their suggestions for phrases you might want to try: the funny bunny hid the colored candy in the colored can. I wonder how that would come out being whispered a couple dozen times. Perhaps the queen sat on her throne and ate thorny kumquats. Now, occasionally in the game, such as telephone, there are those who will intentionally change the word, intentionally change the sentence. Perhaps they're looking to be clever. Perhaps they're looking for to be recognized as someone who's funny. Perhaps they're wanting to even encourage the game and make the outcome much more different than it would have been. But they're intentionally changing the message. They're intentionally passing on something different than what they heard. And when Paul wrote to Timothy, he gave Timothy an assignment to find those who were passing on a different message and to put an end to that, to put a stop to it. So let's read 1 Timothy 1, verses 3. I'll go through 7. 1 Timothy 1, 3. As I urged you when I went into Macedonia, remain in Ephesus, that you may charge some that they teach no other doctrine, nor give heed to fables and endless genealogies, which cause disputes rather than godly edification, which is in faith. Now the purpose of the commandment is love, from a pure heart, from a good conscience, and from sincere faith, from which some, having strayed, have turned aside to idle talk, desiring to be teachers of the law, understanding neither what they say nor the things which they affirm. So today we're going to study Paul's first instruction here to young Pastor Timothy, when he wrote to him, giving him instructions. First, let's note that Paul did two things and urged two things. Paul says, I went into Macedonia. Now, we don't know where he was before that. Acts 20 records that Paul went to Macedonia. But during that trip in Acts 20, Timothy was with him. So if Timothy was with him, then this letter and Paul saying he's going into Macedonia must refer to something else. As we noted that last time we talked, this lends support for the idea that Paul was not crucified on his first arrest. That after he was arrested, he was released and had more ministry to go before a second imprisonment, a second arrest. So Paul said that he went to Macedonia, and it's possible that Paul was with Timothy in Ephesus before that, but that's not certain. We're not quite sure where he was, but he says he was going to Macedonia. So I went, and he says, I urged. Paul urged Timothy, gave him an instruction, gave him something to do. As we noted, Paul urged two things. He says, remain in Ephesus. So Timothy was apparently in Ephesus. He was there doing a job, and Paul asked him to stay and to put things in order. And he says, remain in Ephesus and charge some. Charge some. Give them an instruction. He says, these people are under your care, and I want you to give them a charge. There were three things he was supposed to charge them. One, teach no other doctrine. No other doctrine. That word is heterodidascaline. Big long word. Hetero, which we, I think, know. Hetero means other or different, which is the opposite of homo, meaning the same. And didaskos, teaching. The only time this word is used is later in this book, in chapter 6, verse 3, if anyone teaches otherwise. Teaching something else, something different than what they received. So he told them to teach no other doctrine. He also told them not to give heed to fables. A little later on in this letter, he says, reject profane and old wives' fables. That's the same word. Reject those. Don't give heed to them. And he also said not to give heed to endless genealogies. Could be unfinished genealogies. What are these fables and genealogies? Well, Benson's commentary says the apostle does not speak of those recorded in Scripture, but of the long, intricate pedigrees whereby many of the Jews strove to prove their descent from certain persons. He says that this isn't referring to the Bible, the genealogies in Genesis and Chronicles and various other things. That's what Benson thinks. John Stott has a different idea. In his book on 1 Timothy and Titus, let me read to you a short section from there. He says, the word genealogies, on the other hand, most naturally refers to those in Genesis, which trace the descent and so the pedigree of the patriarchs. It seems that that could be the case, but there's reasons to think otherwise. He says, two ancient Jewish documents may throw light on what Paul is referring to. The first is the Book of Jubilees, which is dated to between 135 and 105 BC, before Christ, so had been around for 200 years by the time Paul was writing this. And he says, the second book is the Biblical Antiquities of Philo. Both books are tendentious rewrites. Tendentious, I had to go look that up. It means they're trying to prove something. They've got a point. They've got a perspective. He says both books are tendentious rewrites of a section of Old Testament history. Both stress the indestructibility of Israel and of the law, and both embellish their story with fanciful additions. The author of the Biblical Antiquities supplements the biblical narrative, quote, by means of his fabulous genealogies, which occupy chapters 1, 2, 4, and 8. Similarly, the book of Jubilees supplies us with the names of all the children of Adam and Eve, of Enoch's family, of Noah's predecessors and descendants, and of the 70 people who went down into Egypt. It may be, then, that it is to this kind of fanciful literature that Paul is referring when he writes of the law, myths, and genealogies. So, good reasons to believe that the Jews of the time were searching through the genealogies, in fact, making up genealogies to prove who they were related to and to put this and that and the other thing, and to make up stories. To make up stories. They weren't passing on what they had heard, what was actually in the Bible. They were making up things. I, some time ago, read through some of the old Jewish commentaries, the Midrash, and the things they came up with are stunning and bear no resemblance to what's in the Bible. Not sure why. Perhaps they were, as I said, seeking for attention in passing on the message, seeking for other things. But that's not what we are called to do. We are called to pass on sound doctrine. Let's go to Titus chapter 1 and verse 5. A couple pages back. Titus. This is the third in the pastoral epistles that were written by Paul. These three go together. They're letters written to pastors instructing them for the care of the church. And Paul shows a pattern here of good stewardship. He says, "For this reason I left you, Titus, in Crete, that you should set in order the things that are lacking." It's very similar to what we read in Timothy. He told him to stay there and to put things in order. "And appoint elders in every city as I have commanded you." I won't go through all of these things, but this section is the qualification of elders. I want you to note that it says in verse 7, "For a bishop must be blameless as a steward of God." A steward, somebody who is responsible for the property of somebody else. The message, the responsibility that they had received was not their own. It was something that had been passed to them, and they were to steward it. To use it wisely on behalf of someone else. Verse 9, "Holding fast the faithful word as he has been taught." What he received, he should hold on to. And then by sound doctrine, both to exhort and convict those who contradict. To be able to use that then to teach sound doctrine, to exhort and convict. And that's just not the responsibility of the elders, of those who have responsibility for others in the church. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 5, verse 12. We were there earlier. Hebrews 5 and verse 12. Paul is writing, or the author, which we believe is Paul, is writing to the members of the congregation. And he says, "For though by this time you ought to be teachers, you need someone to teach you again the first principles of the oracles of God." He says, you've been well versed in this. It's been preached to you. You've studied it and you've known it. And so you ought to be able then to teach it, to be able to use it in conversation. I'm a computer programmer. I write code for a living. And there's all sorts of functions and things built into the languages, and those ones that I use on a regular basis, I know. If I have to find the length of something or various things, I can simply type out those things. There are other statements that I don't use very often. And every time, I've got to go look it up again. I've got to have someone teach me again things that I should know by now. Well, does the search parameter go first or the search string first? I forget. I don't know. I've got to go look it up. Because I haven't used it. And the same is true for us with Scripture. The same is true for us with the things of the God. If we're not using it on a regular basis, we're going to forget. we're going to forget how it all fits together, how it all works. Back to 1 Timothy. And so there's a cause and effect. There's a cause and effect here. He tells them to teach no other doctrine, nor to give heed to fables and endless genealogies, which cause disputes rather than godly edification. Edification, interestingly, in the King James Version is translated stewardship or dispensation. Godly stewardship. If we're arguing over various things, then we're not being good stewards of what God has given us. In the NIV, speaking of multiple translations, the NIV, that word is translated management or administration. We're not managing well what was given to our care if we're off in fables, genealogies, teaching other things. This letter is called pastoral. It's intended to help Timothy as a pastor to manage the church, to shepherd the church under his care, but also teaching him how to be a steward of the things that were handed to him by the apostles, because he spent many years traveling with Paul, traveling with the other ones. And he was taught, he was instructed, and now it's his responsibility to pass that on. When Paul wrote to the Corinthians, he said, our work is going to be tested. Our stewardship is going to be tried. We'll find out if it's wood, hay, or stubble, or gold, silver, and precious gems. So the focus of this section is on sound doctrine. Down at the bottom of verse 10. I'll get there eventually. He's talking about sound doctrine. He starts telling them to preach no other doctrine, and he ends with sound doctrine as the focus. Our world today values tolerance of all ideas. Anybody who's got an idea? Sure, that's your truth. If it's true for you, we'll accept it. Of course, the only thing that they won't accept is those who say there is truth. There is a standard. There is something by which all of our own supposed truths, in quotes, need to be judged. Jesus spoke often of truth. He said, you shall know the truth, and it will set you free. That's John 8:32. And he also said, I am the way. I am the truth. I am the life. He is the standard. His words are the standard by which doctrine must be judged. And so there is a standard of truth. For Timothy, that standard was the words that he had received from the apostles. He'd been traveling with them. He'd received from them. And now he was to teach that. For us, it's the same. It's the word of the apostles. Where do we get that? The words that they have written for us, that they have laid out. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. The story of Jesus Christ, what he said, and the words that have been passed on from him to us by the apostles, all the letters, etc. And Jesus Christ said, he is the way, the truth. There is only one. There aren't multiple different truths. There is one standard, and it's that we need to maintain. So what's the application for us? Well, we need to evaluate doctrine. We need to evaluate teachings. Does it come from Jesus Christ? Does it come from the apostles? Is it part of the word that's been passed down to us? And secondly, does it edify the body or does it cause disputes? If it's causing disputes, that's an indication that we're on the wrong track, that we're discussing things and off into the weeds. No, that's not always the case. That's not always the case. There are times when there is a conflict over something that's central. The mind of God will show us the difference and show us, as we heard, when to answer a fool and when to not answer a fool. But if it's building up the body, if it's edifying, we're probably on the right track. If it's causing disputes, we're probably on the wrong track. Of course, this does not mean that we don't grow, that we don't change our understanding. As we heard, we don't have complete understanding. The infallibility is not with us or with our understanding. The infallibility is with the words that God gave. And our responsibility then is to find, sometimes amongst various translations, sometimes amongst messages that have been changed as they've been passed, what it is that God actually said. Here a little, there a little. And so in this section, we've seen that the letter was written to a pastor to help him guide the members under his care. The first responsibility of stewardship is sound doctrine, to maintain that sound doctrine among a congregation. And as members of that congregation, we have a responsibility to avoid other doctrines, something that does not jive with what we have been given, what we read in the Scripture, and those things that cause disputes. And then we are to pass on those things that we have heard. A short while ago, my wife and I were talking, and she came up with these words. Stance, knock, draw, aim, sorry, anchor, aim, release, follow through. Those words vaguely rattled around. I think I remember those. And she had them off the top of her head from 30 years ago at camp when she was there. And those were the instructions on how to shoot a bow and arrow. We were at SEP, early 80s. There was the activity, and we were given instructions on how to do that, and I'll repeat them because I don't have them in my head, though she has them in hers for some reason. She says, it's amazing, I can remember these things from 30 years ago, but I can't remember my own kids' names. Stance, knock, draw, anchor, aim, release, follow through. And the point of the phrase was to give us steps, to give us a process that was needed in order for us to be able to reliably hit the target. Stand, just so, sideways the target. Knock, put the arrow into that string, and all those various processes. And by doing that, we were much more likely to hit the target that was however far it was away out there. And consistently hitting that target takes diligence. It takes following the process. And when Paul wrote to Timothy, he set that target for him. Verse 5, he says, now the purpose of the commandment is love, from a pure heart, from a good conscience, from sincere faith, from which some have strayed. When I went through my study of this section, I found that there were three words in here that related to hitting an intended target, which is what got me thinking about my wife's words on SNIDARF, I think she said was the acronym. That doesn't stick in my head, but it stuck in hers. The three words that Paul used that relate to hitting an intended target. First is purpose. Now, the purpose of the commandment. That word is telos, Strong's number 5056. Telos, from the primary word telo, which is to set out for a definite point or goal. It means the point aimed at, the thing we're aiming at. The point aimed at as a limit, that is the conclusion of an act or state, the termination, the result, the purpose, the target, it's the thing we're aiming for. It's usually translated in the scriptures here as end. Two examples for you, but he who endures to the end until he reaches the target will be saved. That's Matthew 10:22. Another from Paul's writing in Romans. But now, having been set free from sin and having become slaves of God, you have your fruit to holiness and the end, the goal, the purpose, the target, everlasting life. That's Romans 6:22. And he says here that the end, the point, the goal, the target we're aiming at is love. We'll come back to that. The second word that I found, strayed. Strayed. He says, verse 6, from which some having strayed. That's Strong's word 795, astokeo. I'm not a Greek scholar, so please forgive my translation. Astokeo, from a compound of a, meaning not, the negative, and the second stokeo, which means to aim. Not well aimed. So it means to miss the mark, to miss the target, or that is to deviate from truth. To deviate, when I look that up, it says, means to depart from a set course. The King James translates it as swerved. I'm on a course, I'm heading this way, and we start deviating, we start drifting from that course. Paul says that some were on course, they were on target, but that they've left the course or are now headed in a different direction, now headed elsewhere. The third word that I found was turned aside. Verse 6, he said, from which some having strayed, having turned aside. That's Greek Strong's word 1624. Ektrepo, from ex, meaning out, and trepo, meaning to turn, to deflect, to turn away. Where strayed seems more unintentional, to deflect seems intentional. To set a new target, to set a new course, to set a new goal. Paul used this in the closing section here in 1 Timothy, closing in chapter 6, verse 20, where he said, avoid the profane and idle babblings. That's intentional. We're looking out for it and we're avoiding. We're doing something specific. So their desire was to be teachers of the law. It says they were looking to be teachers of the law. A teacher of the law, a doctor of the law, as it's translated elsewhere, was an important role in Jewish society. And he says some here wanted to be that. They wanted to be the teachers of the law. They'd apparently set for themselves a new goal, a new target, and so they had strayed from the target that was originally set to be good stewards of the words that they had been passed. I found that interesting. So he says, now the purpose of the commandment, and again I got stopped. Well, which commandment? What commandment are we talking about? Let's go, as we were admonished earlier, to various different translations. The Complete Jewish Bible, where it says the purpose of the commandment. Complete Jewish Bible translates this as the purpose of this order. The NIV, New International Version, says the goal of this command. The American Standard Version says, but the end of the charge. The Bible in Basic English, but the effect of the order. In verse 3, Paul says that you may charge some. That's the verb. And the word translated here, commandment, is actually the noun verb. It's the same word. The word for the commandments, when we're talking about the commandments of God in the Bible, is usually entole, but that's not the word that's used here. It's the verb, it's the noun form of the charge. So is he talking about the commandments of God, or was he talking about the instruction that he gave to Timothy? Let me read to you from Ellicott's Commentary for English Readers. He says, there is no reference here to the famous commandments of the law of Moses. Commandment may be paraphrased in this place by practical teaching. Barnes' notes on the Bible says the word commandment here, some have understood of the gospel, others of the particular command which the apostle here gives to Timothy. He says, are we talking about the Which one are we talking about? He says, it seems more naturally to refer to all that God has commanded, his whole law. Well, I think there's perhaps some validity in that. Paul is explaining the purpose I think Paul is explaining the purpose of the and the goal of his instruction for Timothy to stay there and to charge some to stick with the doctrines, which is the same goal, the same target as sound doctrine, and that's the reason to avoid other doctrines. So, given that this word is the same as I charge some, I think he's saying the reason that I'm giving you this instruction is what we shall read here. Now, the purpose of the commandment, the reason for the charge, is love from a pure heart, from a good conscience, and from sincere faith. So the target that Paul sets is love. Agape, that's a word we're well familiar with. 1 John 4:8. Most of us know that, don't we? God is love. When we're shooting for love, we're shooting for God. Jesus Christ is God. He's the Son of God. We saw that in John 1:1. And Paul says, when he wrote to the Romans, we are to be conformed to the image of his Son. That's what we're looking for. We're looking to be just like he is, molded in his image, so that we become love, just as God is love. I have the UCG Chicago Church's study notes on Timothy from 2007. It says, God's commandments show how to love. God's commandments define love. Let's go to Matthew 24 and see this in the words of Jesus Christ himself. Sorry, Matthew 22. Matthew 22, we'll read verses 36 to 40. Matthew 22. The Pharisees came to him and said, "Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law?" Jesus said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind." He took that from the Old Testament. He took that from the instructions given to Israel. This is the first and great commandment. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. He took that from the Old Testament, from the law, from the book of the law. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. So this is the target. The target is love, and then that's broken down to how we show love to God and how we show love to our neighbor. And as we saw earlier, with the processes, the steps, the stance, the draw, the follow-through, etc., there are three stances that Paul gives to help ensure that we hit the target back here in 1 Timothy. The first one, from a pure heart. From a pure heart. When Jesus began his ministry, he said, "Blessed are the pure in heart." Blessed are the pure in heart. I'll read to you from Expositor's Bible Commentary. Commentators are divided on pure in heart. Some take it to mean inner moral purity, as opposed to merely external piety or ceremonial cleanliness. It's an important theme in Matthew and elsewhere in the Scriptures. Others take it to mean single-mindedness, a heart free from the tyranny of a divided self. Divided self, meaning we have two targets. We're striving after two different things, but if we're single-minded, we have one target ahead of us. The pure in heart are thus the utterly sincere. The dichotomy between these two options is a false one, they say. It is impossible to have one without the other. The one who is single-minded in commitment to the kingdom and its righteousness, Matthew 6:33, will also be inwardly pure. Inward sham, deceit, and moral filth cannot coexist with sincere devotion to Christ. And those words sometimes sting, don't they? Inner shame, deceit, and moral filth cannot coexist with sincere devotion to Christ. So when we look at our lives, do we see sincerity? Do we see devotion to Christ? Do we see purity? Or do we see compromise? Do we see filth? If we see compromise, then it's a good possibility that our eye is not on the right target. We're not aimed properly. We're not in a stance of a pure heart. As we said, Matthew 6:33, must be seeking the kingdom first and his righteousness as our target. The second stance is from a good conscience. A good conscience, Barnes notes again. A conscience free from guilt. Of course, there can be no genuine love to God where the dictates of conscience are constantly violated, or where a man knows that he is continually doing wrong. Same point as above. All pretended love, where a man knows that he is living in sin, is mere hypocrisy. From a good conscience, if we are following the conscience that God has given us, guided and directed by the word that God has given us, then our conscience will be clear. But if we are deviating from that, if we are following after other things, if we're aimed at other targets, then our conscience will not be clear. We will not be in the stance of a good conscience. The third stance is from sincere faith. Let's turn over quickly to Hebrews 11. Hebrews 11. You know where I'm going, don't you? Verse 6. Hebrews 11 is, by faith, this person acted. By faith, this person did this thing. And it's that faith that leads to action. Hebrews 11, verse 6, but without faith it is impossible to please him, God. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. Sincere faith is not simply belief by itself. That faith will then lead to action. There will be a follow-through aimed toward the target. Without faith, it is impossible to please him. And so the stance that Paul sets for us is from a pure heart, from a good conscience, and from sincere faith. One final note here on verse 7. Their desire to be teachers seems to be what led them astray, that their desire was not aligned with their skills. He said they don't understand what they're talking about. They don't understand the things that they affirm. They're out there talking and preaching and speaking and teaching, but they don't understand. And so for us, we must be single-mindedly focused on that target. If we change our focus, if we shift it to something else, we're going to stray, we're going to drift, we're going to be deterred, or we're going to miss, we're going to aim somewhere else, and we're going to hit somewhere else. We're not going to hit the target we're aiming for. Our target then is summarized in two great commandments: love the Lord your God with all your heart, and love your neighbor as yourself. And then in the next section, he goes through how we are to do that. But for today, we'll pause. We'll pause here. Are we aimed at the right target? Do we have our mind set on the right thing? Are we taking the message that we have received from the scriptures, from the apostles, and from his teachers, from the words of Christ in the Bible, and faithfully passing those on? being faithful stewards of what we've been given? If so, then we're headed for the right target. We're going to hit and we're going to aim and we're going to hit.